Yeah, so thank you all for coming. So, I mean, this sort of grew out of a discussion a couple days ago with Alstrad and a few others to discuss a few results that we have had recently. So I'll make a little presentation here with the title Alternative Probes of Photoionization Time Delays. And if that title is a little bit provocative, that's on purpose, in the sense that I hope that if anything, that this, what I show you here, that it can stimulate discussion and maybe a little bit different way to look at some of the problems that you're already working on.
Mark, to know there is no provocation.
No provocation yet.
No. Okay. Well. CME.
Okay, so first of all, to my understanding, this is what many of you are working on. So basically, this recent work on delay in photo emission, and so as a result of a number of experiments that have been done, either with streaking, that's the experiment in Garching, or also in a relative experiment.
But that's what many great number of experiments have been done. I know only one experiment from Lund group, and that's it. Maybe you mentioned some other.
Actually, this type of work I will really not talk about any other. Okay. I just show it here as a
reminder. That's the problem. There was a lot of theoretical papers, but not that many experimental.
So you want more experiments? You want more experiments?
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Now he gets happy.
Okay. Just let me know what we need to do. Okay. So anyway, I mean, this is just as a reminder. So this is the Garching experiments, where basically they did a streaking measurement with two separate photoelectron contributions, basically the two different orbitals that were being ionized. And if you analyze this very carefully, you can see that there's a slight offset between the two. So that's then the delay measurement. And this, of course, is the Lund measurement, which gets at quite...
Mark,
yes.
Just a remark regarding Schultz experiment.
Yes.
They say that, well, with the eye, you almost see nothing as a difference between the two.
Yes.
So they say that they perform a frog analysis.
Yes.
Of this to find the delay.
Yes.
So it's much...
It's more sophisticated.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's true. Okay, so anyway, here the Lund experiment that I think you all know, but maybe the question that we should ask ourselves, like is this type of measurement really new? And I think maybe for many people, this was the first time a few years ago that you saw such a measurement where time delay was determined by means of a streaking measurement. But actually, this was an existing technique, and this was a technique that had been applied about 20 years earlier in experiments that I saw quite close by, because it was by colleagues of mine in Amsterdam at the FOM Institute. So one of my colleagues, Bart Noordam, he built this device, or this experiment, I should say. So let me explain to you what you're looking at here. So this is an experiment. It's an experiment with rubidium vapor. So there's a little oven here that sends individual rubidium atoms into the experiment. These rubidium atoms, they are ionized by a femtosecond laser pulse. Nothing special, typically just invisible or so. And the electrons that are formed in this ionization process are sent towards a detector, a position-sensitive detector, by the application of a DC electric field that is here. It's a very, very simple experimental arrangement with only one specialty, that on the way to the detector, these electrons encounter a set of capacitor plates here. And as the laser is sent here, a small part of the laser is also sent onto this switch, and that basically triggers the generation of a voltage on that switch. So that basically means that as the electrons fly here through the capacitor, there's actually a voltage that is ramping up on this capacitor. That basically means that the electrons get a deflection, they're being streaked.
It's like electro-optical streaking camera.
Exactly.
That's what it is.
Exactly. And so basically it means that they get a displacement. If they come very early, the voltage is low, the displacement is low. If they come a little bit later, the voltage has grown and the displacement is larger. Now, and that really works. And so here you see a little test experiment. And so here, actually not just one femtosecond pulse, but two femtosecond pulses were sent into this instrument with a time delay of about 20 picoseconds. And it basically means that on your detector, in two dimensions, you see two stripes, where basically the separation between these stripes, once you've calibrated, tells you that these were two ionization events that came 20 picoseconds apart. Now, obviously, this was not the main thing that this device was used for, the main thing that this device was used for was to look at photoionization dynamics of Rydberg systems. And so here again, you see your rubidium atom. You see how, in the presence of this extraction field, how the Coulomb potential is being distorted, and how you get a saddle point. I mean, very similar to what we always see in our laser experiments. And it basically means that the experiment was now done, exciting the atom a little bit above this saddle point, and that basically means that this streak hammer here you can use to time resolve the ionization event. Now, and that is basically what this measurement here shows, and shows you that the ionization in this case is not a single burst of electrons that comes out, but actually that the electrons come out in a few bursts, where basically the separation between the bursts has to do with the orbital period of the electron. And basically the electron has an orbital period determined by the electric field, and basically whenever there's an interaction of the electron with the core, then that changes the direction of the electron, and then there's a chance that the electron will find its way over the saddle point on the way to the detector. And so that is one message. I mean, the reason that I'm showing you this here is that you can see that in Rydberg physics, some of the concepts that we are now working on in ultrasecond science already exist, in fact, have already existed for a long time. Now, that is then also where I'm now going to go in my presentation. I'm going to show you experiments that we do, that we've sort of always done on the side over the last years, on Rydberg photoionization dynamics. And as you'll see towards the end, we are actually able to extract time domain information from these measurements.
Mark, yes? Can I ask a question regarding the I understand that, and as you say, it is not new, but what was new in Schultz and Lund experiments, and Lundy's and others' experiments, was the attosecond scale.
Yes.
Not the picoseconds, I mean. Mm-hmm. There is a qualitative difference which is important.
Yes, oh no, absolutely.
Well, my question is, does such a setup could see something at the scale of the attosecond, say 10 or 100 attosecond?
No, I don't think so. I think the best time resolution that was possible in this instrument at the time was something like a fraction of a picosecond, half a picosecond thereabout. I mean, okay, it's 20 years ago, maybe these days you would be able to do a little bit better, but there's quite fundamental limitations with I mean, this contains real electronics, right?
Okay.
And I think anything that is not really directly based on optical interaction, you never
know. That's actually the range of commercially available optoelectric sticking cameras.
Yes.
You can buy them off the shelf.
Yeah, it also goes to something like 300-400 femtoseconds, as far as I know, is more or less the best you can get, right? And I think that, I mean, that's going to be hard to beat, I think. That's more or less the lower level that you can reach. Yes.
I'm not only sure I remember correctly because of the time ago, but one key requirement was the Rydberg wave package.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
Yes.
So what you want to really measure is the slow motion, almost classical motion of the Rydberg wave.
Yes, exactly.
So that would be the other difference too. Because in the other experiments, of course, think of the quantum mechanical stationary state you start with.
Here basically there's a single initial state, right? And as opposed to, let's say, the Garching experiment, in a way.
But also maybe
they
expect more of the quantum mechanical properties, but here more the almost classical. You describe this circular motion on the classical, almost classical.
Yeah, which is of course also very well described quantum mechanical.
In this case, what are
many states? The wave thing is many states, right? Well, in the Garching experiment, there's just one or two.
I mean, it depends on what you consider the starting point of the experiment. So I would say the starting point of the experiment in Garching is basically these two electronic states that exist before the experiment. In this particular experiment, that's really just one. It's the ground state of the atom. Of course, as an intermediate after the laser excitation, then it's a wave packet, then it's many states.
Okay, but you broke this away.
And that is what you then.
And
we're
probably in the other case with the beating or whatever. So this means here you don't have phase information, not even.
Not here, but then what I will show you later, we will have to. We will have to. I mean, that's where I'm going in this talk.
Could I ask, what in this picture there are two pulses? What are the where do they come from? Because I see only one. I mean, the
This is a test experiment. So here they set up a little Michelson interferometer to send a pulse pair into the instrument, simply because they wanted to see the time resolution that they could achieve. And then later the real experiment, then it was a single pulse going into the experiment, and then the time structure really comes from the atom. And so also in this case, photo excitation also was far above this saddle point. It was just a direct photo ionization, more or less instantaneous response from the atom, just with two pulses. Okay, so this is a little bit what I'm going to talk about. I mean, how some of the concepts that I think many of you are interested in, how we also encounter these concepts in Rydberg physics, how I think there's interesting things that we're already able to do in Rydberg physics, and towards the end especially also, I mean, whether perhaps experiments that exist in Rydberg, in the Rydberg community, whether they can serve as an inspiration for things that we should try and do in the other second field. Okay, so let me start. I've divided this in three parts, and the first part that I'm to get you acquainted with the topic a little bit. And the first part I'm going to talk about is basically resonant photoionization, photoionization microscopy is how we call the technique, of hydrogen atoms. Now, like I said, in my research group, this work goes back quite a long time. It's basically work that when I started my group in AMO, so around the year 2000, we had this as a little test experiment on the side. Okay, so the first result that I'm going to show you is really one of the simplest experiments that you can do in atomic physics. It's basically where you say, I take an atom. In our case, for convenience, we took a metastable xenon, and because it has a nice small ionization potential. We ionize the atom with a narrowband light, so we're not going to use femtosecond pulses or attosecond pulses. We use nanosecond pulses with a very well-defined wavelength. And so we know the total energy that we are putting in. And we basically photoionize the atom and detect the photoelectrons with a velocity map imaging detector. And so that basically means that we drive the electrons towards a two-dimensional detector. I already mentioned this 2 days ago, right, where we measure the position where the electrons arrive. Now here you see the relevant potentials. I mean, the dashed red line is basically the Coulomb potential that would be relevant if there was no electric field. Of course, here in our detector, we have a DC electric field, and it basically means that the Coulomb potential is distorted, and the potential that will be relevant to us is the solid black line. It has the normal saddle point formation that you, of course, also have in your laser field. And it basically means that in this experiment, as soon as my photon energy raises the atom above this saddle point here, then ionization becomes possible. Now, that is simply going to be our experiment. We're going to scan this laser here and then record photoelectron images as a function of the photon energy that we send in. Very simple experiment. Now here a little reminder about the velocity map imaging technique. So very simple, we produce electrons or ions. In this case we're interested in electrons, and with a DC electric field and followed by a drift region, we make a projection on a two-dimensional detector. And so typically the way that we use this technique is that if we have a proper axis of cylindrical symmetry in the experiment, then what we measure is a 2D projection of the three-dimensional velocity distribution. And then normally what we do is, by means of an inversion algorithm, we recover the three-dimensional distribution. This is how we use the technique, how many people use this technique.
Are there also multi-photon rings?
This particular image that you see here is for an ATI experiment. So this is ATI of xenon, as far as I can tell.
And you are measuring ions or electrons?
Electrons. Yeah. Okay, so this is ATI strong field. I mean, the type of images that we might anticipate now is, like I said, I mean, we start from a well-defined, from an atom in a well-defined state. We apply an electric field, so we know exactly where the saddle point is that has a well-defined energy. We send in photons with a well-defined energy. So that basically means we're making photoelectrons with a very well-defined energy, right? And it basically means that in principle, what we would expect is like what you see from another.
One more question?
Yes.
If they are multi-photon, they should have different angular distribution patterns.
Yes.
And they are.
Yes, absolutely. Actually, the image that you see here, this is two-photon ionization of metastable argon by second harmonic of a YAG laser. There you see this typical four-fold pattern for two-photon ionization, right? So the combination of S and D. Okay, so this in principle what we would have expected. Well-defined kinetic energy in the basic means that when you recover the 3D distribution, this is a slice through the 3D distribution, you basically recognize that one velocity that corresponds to that particular photoelectron energy. That's in principle what we would expect to see. But what we see is very different. And so here you see a series of images. In this case, it's two-photon ionization from this metastable state using a light around 650. And what I'm showing you here are a range of images, you know, as we slowly scan the wavelength of the laser. And so we start here at the long wavelength limit, where we have a dot on the detector. That's basically where we're exciting the system right at the saddle point. There's no excess energy, so we basically are forming the electron with close to zero kinetic energy. Now, then as we slightly reduce the wavelength, increase the photon energy, we expect that our dot grows into a ring. However, we already see something that's a little bit unusual. It's a ring that always has a dot in the center. And as if we always keep making electrons with zero kinetic energy, which we don't, because we know all the energies in our problem. Then we continue scanning the laser. The ring gets bigger and bigger. And then somewhere around here, again, something kind of strange happens. It's basically that the ring that has grown up to that moment over a relatively narrow change in the photon energy disappears, and it's replaced by a new ring that grows out of the dot that we've seen all along. And so the dot here is still a dot. Here it kind of begins to grow, and here it's already really the ring. So that can be summarized in this contour plot. This contour plot is from a UV one photon experiment, but it's basically the same thing. And so we have a long wavelength limit. And from the long wavelength limit, we see that the ring starts to grow, but then at some point, at a particular photon energy, the ring is rather rapidly replaced by a new ring that grows out of the center. Now, this behavior, we've been able to model quite well using classical trajectory calculations. Basically, classical trajectory calculations where you consider the motion of the electron not just under the influence of the DC electric field, which normally in velocity map imaging is the only thing we think about, that the DC electric field drives the electron towards the detector. But as it turns out, because the electrons that we're making here are very slow, we're working right around the saddle point, we really have to take into account what the Coulomb interactions do. And if you take both interactions into account, then actually you can reproduce such a pattern very easily. And what you see then is that at threshold, so just above the saddle point, you initially have trajectories where the electron is very strongly affected by the Coulomb interaction. It may even hang around the ion for a little while before it escapes. And only later, when you're farther above the saddle point, I mean, then you get simpler trajectories, this blue one here, for example, where the electron is simply driven towards the detector by the DC electric field. And so really, the observation is really due to the fact that we're working close to the saddle point, where both interactions are important.
What happens that when you have this jump? I mean, perhaps I missed something important. Is it this jump that you have here?
Yeah, so that's basically this point in the measurement here, where over for a relatively small change in the photon energy, we have a qualitative change in what the dominant trajectories are.
Okay.
So up to that energy, the trajectories are predominantly complicated. We call them indirect trajectories. And from that point on, they're predominantly direct trajectories, simpler trajectories.
Okay.
But I'll look at these trajectories in a little bit.
And what was the Kildish parameter in this experiment? Is it multi-photon or tunneling?
This is a single photon with the weakest laser you can imagine.
So it was a multi-photon regime.
So I've never calculated the Kildish parameter, but it's probably something like 1,000 or 10,000.
Uh-huh.
It plays no role. Okay, so let's look at these trajectories in a little bit more detail that we had. So here you see some of the trajectories that bring the electron from the atom that is sitting here to a detector that I've positioned here. I've positioned it a bit closer to get it on the slide. So basically what you see is that there's a whole range of trajectories. In fact, you can derive there's an infinite number of trajectories that can take the electron from here to there. And basically what distinguishes these electrons is how long they stay near the ion. And so basically how many oscillations they make around the ion before they finally take off and move towards the detector. What I also show here, and let me briefly point it out because I will use this later, is a classification of these trajectories. These trajectories we describe in parabolic coordinates. So it basically means there's one label, that's the number that you see, is basically the number of oscillations that we see in the Xi parabolic coordinate. And then we give them an index plus or minus. The plus or minus basically counts the number of times that they cross the axis and whether that is equal to this number or whether that's this number minus one. That's the two possibilities. Okay. Yes.
Mark, how the here it's a coordinate perpendicular to the detector axis.
Yes.
But on the experimental image, it was a number of pixels from the center or what?
Let's see.
How it is related to the energy or the velocity or whatever.
So
it's related to?
No. Actually, it's. I mean, all the electrons that we detect have the same energy.
Ah, so okay. 3D
reconstructed image.
This is the raw data.
This is the raw.
Yeah. And
zero momentum.
Yeah, but zero momentum here really only means that it's zero momentum in the plane of the detector, because that's the only thing we. I mean, since we have the Coulomb interaction playing such an important role here, basically means that the cylindrical symmetry that we normally have in our experiment, that comes from the polarization axis of the laser, that cylindrical symmetry is broken here. And as a result of that, because also the electric field, the DC electric field is very important, and the DC electric field, of course, breaks the cylindrical symmetry that we would have along the polarization axis. And so as a result of that, the only thing we can do is measure these 2D projections. We cannot recover the 3D distribution from these projections. It's not possible. And so the basic means that all the electrons that we measure have the same energy. And if anything, the radius where we measure the electrons here relates to the ejection angle that they have. Like if anything, it's an angular distribution measure. Okay, so far what I've explained to you is that we have this measurement. We can analyze it quite well with classical trajectories. And I've shown you some of these trajectories that connect the atom to particular points on the detector. Now, that of course means that here I'm doing something that's a bit flaky, right? In the sense that any time in quantum mechanics that I connect two points by means of many pathways, I don't expect that a classical treatment is going to be good. Now, and that actually also turns out to be correct. In a sense, we've improved the experiment a little bit. And when you improve the experiment, that basically means zooming the images up, then actually you start to see quantum mechanical interferences. And so here we see interference patterns, and when we continue the experiment, then at some point actually these interference fringes, they really become quite numerous. Now, also this we can calculate. Again, we calculate it on the basis of the classical trajectories, but now what we need to do is basically keep track of the phase accumulation along the trajectories, or basically calculate the action along the trajectories, and then if we reconstruct an image taking that into account, we also find the interference fringes in our calculations. And here you see a comparison between measured dark fringes from images like there and the calculation, and this really agrees very well. So that was really nice. So at that time, we were quite happy with these results. But at the same time, we were also very disappointed by these results. And let me now explain to you why we were very disappointed by these results. The reason that we were disappointed by these results is basically because of this measurement here. And so what you see here for the case of xenon, this curve shows the photoionization efficiency curve. So basically the number of electrons that we measure per laser shot or a little bit average as a function of the photon energy that we send into, or as a function of where we excite the system. Now, what you recognize here is a stark stark map or stark structure, where basically all the Rydberg states that we initially had at zero field have fanned out into a stark manifold, and basically in our measurement we're taking a cut through this manifold. The dots that I indicate here are clearly recognizable members of one stark manifold, so a number of states that connect to the same principal quantum number or the same origin. And those eight measurements actually are the eight measurements that I showed you a moment ago. And so basically these eight measurements, they were taken at those eight peaks. And initially what we were hoping is that by the time that we would be able to see quantum mechanical interferences, that these interferences would tell us something about the nature of the wave functions that we are exciting here. But that's clearly not the case, because whatever the quantum numbers are for these states, we couldn't really assign them. But whatever they are, we would certainly expect that when you go from one peak to the next, the quantum numbers are going to change by one. Right? And in the images that I showed you, this was clearly not the case. We had a much more gradual change of the number of fringes. And like I said, I mean, the fringes could basically be understood by a Feynman path interval type analysis, so just keeping track of the action in the experiment.
So, do I get it right that the angular momentum of the initial state was not imprinted in this angular distribution?
No, not at all. Not at all.
But it should have been.
Sorry?
It should have been.
It's what we were hoping, but it turned out not to be the case. Okay. And if you can wait a bit later, I will come back to this. Why? At that time, we had a hard time understanding why it didn't work. Meanwhile, we understand it. And one of the results that I'll show you a bit further down is actually where we can control it, whether we see it or not. Okay, so more recently we have a solution to this problem, in the sense that what we believed at the time is that the reason that we did not see the quantization of the state probably had to do with electron correlation, probably had to do with the fact that this Rydberg electron, when it interacts with the core, it's not just interacting with a positive ion core, but it's also all the other electrons that can mess things up. And therefore, the solution is to perform the experiment for hydrogen atoms.
But the Rydberg electron is so far away, it's essentially a hydrogenic system.
That's what I initially also was hoping, but that turns out not to be the case. And in a moment, we'll see it in helium, where sometimes it is hydrogenic and sometimes it isn't. So it's quite tricky.
How large was the quantum defect in your
case? In xenon, it's larger. I mean, xenon is probably one of the worst cases you can. Okay, but now briefly the case of hydrogen. I mean, in hydrogen, as I think you probably know, the Stark Hamiltonian is separable in parabolic coordinates. Right? So basically, you can write the wave function in this way. And really, the important thing is that there is a separation constant. So basically, the energy that you have in your system, you can separate into a part. That relates to the motion for the xi coordinate, a part that relates to the motion for the eta coordinate. And importantly, this separation constant, this separation of the energy in two parts, is field independent. So that basically means it's the same in the approximately 500 volt per centimeter field where we excite, and half a meter downstream on our detector where the field is essentially zero. So that basically means that if we do such an experiment for hydrogen, then in our entire experiment, from excitation to detection, hydrogen is described by the same wave function. And that really makes all the difference. And so this is the experiment that we've now done. Of course, hydrogen is a bit harder. We first have to produce it. So we made a photolytic source of hydrogen atoms using H2S as a precursor molecule. And then basically using a two-step excitation with two tunable lasers, we again went near the center point.
But it isn't always the same wave function. This is an interesting statement. I mean,
Let's put it this way.
It goes all the way to the end.
There's one wave function
the final state,
that describes basically the situation is you have close to the atom and also far away.
There's one Hamiltonian which describes that. The same Hamiltonian with the same separation constant. The wave function changes.
I would say that at a particular energy, your wave function has a part that is localized near the atom, and it has a continuum part. Right? Of course, what we measure is the continuum part. So in that sense, I would.
What do you mean when you say it's independent of the energy? Can you phrase that at the top? Separation is independent of the energy. What is that?
I mean, if you write your wave function like this, and if you stick this into the Schrödinger equation, right, then you get you can extract an equation for this function that describes the motion along the psi coordinate. You can extract an equation for this function, motion along the other coordinates. And it basically means that the total energy that you have in the system, I mean, part of it, so there's basically a separation constant that describes which part of the energy goes into this motion and which part of the energy goes into that motion. And that separation constant is independent of the strength of the electric field.
But you said, but you have a star shift, and I think maybe the statement is approximate.
As far as I know, it's exact.
You don't know exactly what it means. Because if you change the field strength, you will change the energy of the balance by the charge of mixing the separabilities.
Yeah. So basically you can derive two separate
separability.
Yes.
The constant separation is the same. It's independent.
I mean, but you have separation constants that depend on the field.
No, in this case, they don't depend on field.
No,
they depend on the quantum.
The constant doesn't depend on field. It depends only on the quantum numbers.
Yes.
I don't think that.
Yes,
that's the peculiarity of hydrogen. That's only true for hydrogen.
And you get an additional potential in one of the coordinates through the field. But this does not change
in
the
both
separation
both.
Constant. Yeah. I mean, the dynamics is different out of the field, but not the separation constant.
So, I mean, I've written this down. I said you have the beta 1 and the beta 2.
Yes.
And I think they depend weakly. Like the ground state energy of the hydrogen, first it's independent of the field, but if you make the field strong, you have a star shift. And I think in a similar way, the separation constant.
I can't judge if it's the stuff that I read, if this is exact to all orders, but in the formalism as I read it, the separation constant is really field independent to all orders as far as I know. Okay, so that makes the hydrogen really special. So here you see the experiments for hydrogen. So this was what we published last year. So basically here you see a set of three measurements. Two measurements here on either side where we're ionizing directly into the continuum. We see exciting directly into the continuum. And one case in between where we're hitting one of the stark resonances. Right, and basically what you see here immediately is that on resonance, I mean, the images look radically different. And on resonance, I mean, you really see the quantization structure of the quantization of the stark state that you're exciting. And so in this case, you can immediately read off that this was a state where N1, that's one of the parabolic quantum numbers, where N1 was equal to 2. Now, and then, of course, you can do this for various of these stark states. So here we're basically scanning over the Stark manifold, again, like in xenon jumping from one state to the next. But now, every time that you do this, you add a fringe to your interference path. Okay, now comes the comic relief. So we published this paper, and then a couple days later, I got an email from my PhD student who said, you know, you have to go on the internet because somebody posted one of these images on Facebook, and then all hell broke out. I mean, there was lots of discussions on Facebook about this result, and at the end of the day, 70,000 people had said that they liked this experiment. It's really amazing. But I want to show you some of the comments as well. let's not go to the Facebook page. So people were really amazed that you could now actually do this. Actually, a lot of people also felt that it was fraudulent or so what we had done. This was really forbidden, and if you're bad scientists. People felt a little bit sorry for the hydrogen atom, which probably never expected to be photographed like this. We're really impressed that you can photograph something sharply that small. Not everybody was very positive about it. People. I think you can read for yourself. But fortunately, this was balanced by other people who thought that this was a really very important development, that surely if we can do things like this, then the cure of cancer is right around the corner. And finally, probably you can also very soon get one yourself by going to InterToys or something. All right. So we continued. And so now what I'm going to show you is the extension of this experiment to helium. And that is actually then where we come to what Anatoly was asking, yeah? Like, to what extent is helium a hydrogenic system or not? So we did similar measurements in helium. So here you see a whole series of these images. And again, I mean, as we're slowly increasing the photon energy, you see how very slowly there's an evolution in the interference pattern. But what you can also see is that some measurements that we did, I mean, these are in order of photon energy, some measurements look really weird. You see that this image is suddenly bigger than the two that are surrounding it. And also this image looked bigger. One thing that I should mention about the helium experiment, in helium, it was the nature of the experiment, we could only do measurements on resonances. And so in between resonances, the signal was too weak. We couldn't get good data. Every measurement that you see here corresponds to a particular star peak that we've measured.
So this is photoionization, yeah. Helium with tricyclotron lasers?
With the narrowband laser, narrowband tunable laser, that we're very slowly scanning. And so similar to the xenon experiment, we're very slowly scanning the photon energy in the region around the cell.
What's the
region?
This
was a doubled CW ring dilator. So the wavelength was something like 320 or so. Again, starting from a metastable state for convenience. Okay, so the analysis. As it turns out, for most of these measurements, so basically all the measurements that look kind of normal, without the ones that I highlighted, you can basically do the same analysis as for xenon. And so it basically means that, again, you see that the fringe patterns really are given by the phase accumulation along the trajectory. That is really, it's the same story. So here actually is part of the excitation spectrum. And so these measurements that I'm showing you basically are on all of these peaks that we could identify. And you really here see also that there's hardly any intensity between the peaks that was different in hydrogen. So that's why we couldn't take measurements there. Now, for these peaks, we can make assignments. Fortunately, we didn't have to do this ourselves, but there were some calculations that were done for this. And that actually brings out the peculiarity of these measurements, in the sense that when you look at the quantum numbers that describe these, which basically in each case, the principal quantum number is given, and then the first parabolic quantum number, so that's basically the number that in the case of hydrogen was 1, 2, or 3 in the measurement. And you see, in these cases, the second quantum number, the parabolic quantum number, is always very high, or at least it's never very low.
This is the Rydberg states of helium, so there's one electron in the 1s, so to say, and
yes.
The other one is sitting up.
Yes. And so basically what we see is that all of these, all of the peaks that we see in the spectrum are from so-called blue Stark states. So that basically states in the Stark manifold where the electron density is kind of concentrated away from the saddle point. I mean, that is what gives these states a lifetime, and that is what makes that in an excitation spectrum that they appear as sharp resonances. In the case of helium, when you look at the excitation spectrum, you don't see any red Stark states. And that's probably because when you excite the system already in the direction of the saddle point, the lifetime is just too short. In this state, will just immediately ionize. And so that was quite remarkable. And by the way, that also explains why this experiment now behaves so much like xenon, in the sense that why the interference patterns that we see, why they are really governed by the path length along the trajectory. In the sense that when you think about the ionization mechanism of these blue Stark states, I mean, that basically occurs by means of mechanisms that, is, that in a way is quite similar to atomic order ionization. In the sense that, I mean, initially what we excite is a wave function that has a quantization in along both parabolic coordinates and is bound along both parabolic coordinates. And the system manages to get into the continuum by exchanging energy between these two coordinates. And so that basically means that in an interaction with the core, energy is transferred from one parabolic coordinate to the other, and thereby you get over the saddle point and on the way to the detector. But it basically means that in this process, any information about the initial wave function that we excite and what its quantization was is essentially lost. And so that is why why the interference pattern that we see, why they are really only given by the path. And in retrospect, that was also the reason why in xenon that was the explanation. At that time, we didn't understand it, but now we understand it a little bit better. You mean these line shapes here? I mean, we haven't made a thorough line analysis, but what I would suspect is that these are Fano-like line shapes. I mean, there must be a kind of interference between, let's say, the resonant contribution that really stands out and a very weak underlying continuum, and presumably they're interfering giving rise to it. But it's not something that we've really tried to end.
So are you saying that the blue states would be kind of stable in the purely hydrogenic system, and they only...
Actually, in the hydrogenic system, they're too stable.
Yeah.
And so in hydrogen, the blue state lives so long that we don't see them. So in the case of hydrogen, the lifetimes that we need for the experiment, which need to be sort of in the 100 nanosecond range, so that it's a sharp peak, but at the same time, the thing goes, that you encounter for the red state. Okay, so now let's look a little bit at these few measurements that we had that stood out. And for this, we have to look at the Stark map of helium. And so I've already talked about this in words a little bit. So here you basically see how in a Rydberg atom, the moment that you place the atom in an electric field, the degeneracy of the high L state breaks up and basically the states fan out into a Stark manifold. This is also what you have in hydrogen. In hydrogen, all these states really cross. In helium, because there's finite quantum defects, there's really a coupling between these states, and that's why all the crossings are avoided. Now, that turns out to be very important for the explanation of our result, in the sense that these measurements that we have seen here and there occasionally that looked different from the majority of the measurements were all in the vicinity of an avoided crossing. And it basically means that we're there looking at states that are no longer have this pure blue or this pure red character, but that actually are interacting with each other and that take on a kind of mixed character. And so near an avoided crossing, I mean, as a result of the coupling between the states that we are really dealing with are linear combinations of the blue and the red state with a mixing coefficient that it basically is going to be field dependent. Scanning across the avoided crossing, then basically this alpha is going to be field dependent. Now that has very interesting consequences because we can look at the decay of these states, and the decay of this state is then basically given by a matrix element, a coupling to the ionization continuum. And it basically means that what you recognize here is that this is a matrix element that's going to contain the sum of two contributions. Now these contributions, they can be either positive or negative. It basically means that for one particular field strength, for one particular mixing angle, the two can largely cancel each other. Now that basically means that there, what is nominally a very short-lived red state, way too short so that we would never see it, can suddenly become a rather long-lived state, long enough that we can see its hydrogenic behavior. And that is actually exactly what happened in these 8 special cases that we have encountered. All of these were near an avoided crossing where there was a mixing of the red state and the blue state. that also explains why we have this qualitative difference between these images that I had highlighted, where the red character comes out, and the states, the blue states that auto-ionize, in the sense that the ionization mechanism of these red states is basically a tunneling process, and that tunneling process basically leaves the quantization intact that we have along the Xi coordinate. Whereas in the auto-ionization process, some of the energy that we have in the Xi motion gets transferred to the eta motion in order to get over the saddle point, and as a result, there's less remaining in the Xi motion, the image that we see is smaller. And so this really reveals this difference in the ionization process. Okay, so that is what we saw for helium. And how where in a sense you see how with the field you can tune whether helium behaves as a single active electron atom, and whether the hydrogenic behavior comes out, or whether it behaves as a multi-electron atom, where the coupling between the two electrons is really important. So in that sense, and this is probably general for many atoms, I would think. Okay, now in the last part, I want to come back to hydrogen. I'm going to show you a few more experiments on hydrogen that we've done. And the distinction between these experiments and the experiments that I've shown before is that we're now going to look at non-resonant excitation. So now we're not going to look on stark resonances, but we're going to look on purpose in between the stark resonances. Now, so there also we've done a whole series of measurements. And these measurements are summarized in this plot. And so here you see where we are scanning the energy. So basically what the horizontal scale is basically the ratio of the energy over the saddle point energy. And so the basic means ionization becomes possible at epsilon is 1. And here at epsilon is 0, we would be at the field-free ionization limit. And what I hope you can see, I mean, we're still working on the on the data. And we're hoping also to bring the effect out a little bit stronger. But I hope you can see that there is a kind of complicated interference pattern here, a kind of checkerboard pattern where on the one end, you see there's fringes running like this, but at the same time, standing a little bit too close to it, there's fringes that run like this. And what I'm now going to try and convince you is that that contains time domain information, this crosswise interference pattern. Okay, and I'm going to do that by means of a calculation, because in the calculation it looks much cleaner, it looks much sharper. And so now, again, we're doing these semi-classical calculations, where we calculate classical trajectories, and we also calculate the classical action so that we can make an interference pattern. And what I've done now is that I've separated the different classes of trajectories that I've already introduced to you. And so on the one end we have the indirect trajectories. Those are the ones that, as you remember, started right at threshold. And that's basically the interference pattern that you get when you follow these indirect trajectories as a function of energy. Now we can do the same for the direct trajectories. And that's the trajectories where initially there was a dot, and then at some particular energy, a new interference pattern started growing. And that is basically the interference pattern for these direct trajectories, if you would be able to measure them separately. Now, and this is the complete result. This is if you have all the trajectories in your calculation. And then, indeed, you see that there is a kind of checkerboard-like interference pattern appearing here. And you can compare it with what we've seen experimentally. Certainly qualitatively and even semi-quantitatively, it's the same. So what I now want to analyze then a little bit is, what is the condition that creates constructive interference in this interference pattern? And so that basically means that I'm going to look at the direct trajectories. And so again here, for one particular calculation here, you see the green trajectory and the blue trajectory are two direct trajectory that will lead to detection of the electron somewhere below this zero axis. And the red trajectory and the black trajectory are two trajectories that initially start out on this side, but then somewhere far, far downstream will cross the axis and will go towards the same point where the other trajectories are going. And so I want to analyze now these interference patterns, what the interference conditions are for seeing constructive interference. Now, that's in a way a tricky question, because and so here at different times we have electrons arriving on the detector with different phases. And it's clear that we have an interference pattern related just to the direct trajectories. We have an interference pattern related to the indirect trajectories, and we have the beating between the two. And so the question is, in a way, we have four phases associated with these four trajectories. I mean, in principle, there are more indirect trajectories, but they have less and less weight, so I'm going to neglect them. They don't really play a role in the experiment. There's really only four important trajectories, and three relative phases. And so in that sense, I mean, that begs the question, and what is the, which phases are now really important, and which relative phases are important for deciding whether in the checkerboard pattern we see a constructive or a destructive interference. Now, and the answer basically turns out to be this. I mean, in this checkerboard pattern, on the one hand, the 0 plus and the 1 minus trajectory have to be in phase. That basically means that we have to be on a fringe for the direct photoionization pathway. And in addition to that, we see in the analysis that the 1 plus and the 1 minus trajectory, so one of these is a direct trajectory, the other one is an indirect trajectory, these have to be in phase. So that basically means that now we can superimpose assignments of these interference fringes. And so it basically means, of course, I haven't done it for all, but for a few of these now, I've labeled the interference fringe with two numbers. One is n direct. And so basically, that's a measure of the phase difference between the two direct trajectories that we have at that point. Basically saying that the phase difference between these two trajectories is 2 times 2 pi. And at the same time, I've put a label n direct indirect, and that's basically the phase difference between this one direct trajectory and the one indirect trajectory. That is 1 plus and the 1 minus. So this would basically mean that at this point, that phase difference is 2 times 2 pi, and at this point here, it's 22 times 2 pi. And the phase difference between the direct and the indirect trajectory. Now, what I'm now going to convince you of, that basically converts this axis into a time axis. Because this phase accumulation between the direct and the indirect trajectory is really a measure of time delay. It's caused by, time delay is caused by the trajectories being very different in these cases. Now, that is illustrated by this here. And so here, for the two fringes that I've considered, the one where the phase difference was 4 pi, and the one where the phase difference was 44 pi, I'm showing you, firstly, basically the radius where we detect the electron as a function of the ejection angle. And so that basically means that the radius in the interference pattern basically corresponds to these four trajectories here. And you see that in this case, on this curve, the 1 plus and the 1 minus trajectory are very close to each other, just on the other side, on either side of the two axes. And it basically means also that these trajectories are very, very similar. I mean, except for the fact that this red trajectory we know very, very far away is still going to cross the axis. But otherwise, it's essentially the same motion as the green trajectory. And it basically means that there's not going to be much delay between these trajectories. They come almost at the same time. Now, that's very different for this other interference point that I pointed out, where the difference was 44 pi. That basically corresponds to this calculation in these four trajectories. And here you see that the 1 plus and the 1 minus trajectory are really far away from each other. And as a result of that, that basically corresponds to the two trajectories being very, very different. And so the green trajectory, the direct one, again, goes relatively quickly towards the detector. But in this case, the red trajectory actually first moves away from the detector, gets turned around by the field, and then finally finds its way towards towards the same point. Actually, here in the bottom, you can see the trajectory over the entire scale. Now, that basically means that, or that basically suggests that there is time domain information in that phase difference that we see between the trajectories. Now, and to see if this is true, if this is reasonable, what I'm now going to show you is a plot where I plot the time difference between the arrival of this direct and this indirect trajectory, which I can simply monitor in my calculation. I plot as a function of this index that I give these points. So this was index 2, this was index 22. And in this plot, I will plot all of these points that are highlighted here. And so not just for this fringe, but I plot it for all the fringes that we have there. Now, that basically gives this curve here. So here you see the time delay. Okay, on other second time scales, it's a very long time delay. You see it's a couple hundred picoseconds. As a function of this fringe index, so basically the index that keeps track of the phase difference between the direct and the indirect trajectory. And you see, to quite a good approximation, this is a line. That was a linear slope. So it basically means this fringe index basically tells us how much time delay there is between the two.
But. This is not true.
This is not true.
Approximately true in chance, or maybe generically, but not in theory, because what you measure is an action.
Yes.
We agree on that, right?
The yes, action. Absolutely.
And the action is P times X, if you wish, P dx plus E times T. So you have two components, the true time
yes.
component and the component which comes from work, basically. And so if the potential, these two trajectories explore, is really identical, then I think the Px is identical, and you can get rid of that in the difference between the two. But if the two trajectories explore very different potential landscapes on their way out, then you will have a phase difference because of that, which is not indicative necessarily of a time difference.
Yes, I think you're right. I think to some extent, I mean, that is also why you see that there are some points that lie a little bit farther away from this line. Those actually, I think, correspond to cases where the trajectories, the parts of the potential that are a little bit more different. So in that sense, I mean, I don't want to present this as a mathematical proof. I mean, not basically, it's the empirical.
It's probably the concept of telling something about time differences, because you can only be sure that it's a time difference if you know exactly what the system does and what the trajectories do. Then I agree with you.
Yes.
You can exclude that, no, it comes from potential differences, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But as a, how to say, as a diagnosis tool, or that's very, very problematic, I would say.
Okay, this I cannot judge. I mean, I've seen it work in this situation, and here it seems to be working reasonably well. I can't tell how general it would be.
I think, because I don't understand it, if you have if you explore a different potential landscape, isn't that that is giving you time?
No, I mean, it has two parts, right? I mean, if you call the phase a time, just in general, then you do that, but this, I don't think you want to do that. I mean, because then you simply translate interference ranges into just time. But I don't think you want to do that, right? It's a bit more specific what you want to do.
Well, I mean, that was a bit question that I wanted.
For instance, you can say if something goes over a deep potential, right?
Yeah.
It accumulates a lot of phase, but it's very fast, in a sense.
Yeah.
And so on. And you have both. You have an energy component, that is E times T and P dx. So what do you attribute to time? Or?
But doesn't the number of fringes correlate with time?
Yeah, but I don't think it's the time you have in mind. It's
the time is relative, so to speak. It really depends on if you explore the same situation, then yes, you compare it with respect to the same whatever potential you explored. So let's say you have the same potential, right? And you are once fast, you have a high energy and a low energy, two trajectories. Then you have a time difference, if you think of free motion, and this will come out because there's no correction of the potential. Now these trajectories, by chance, the fast one with high energy and the other one with low energy, the slow one, explore very different landscapes. This might spoil the time difference due to the energy, which you probably naively would expect or correlate with the time difference.
Yeah, but I mean, normally this Wigner-Smith is it is a phase difference, but between two different energies of the wave pattern. Mm-hmm. So here, are you saying that it's because you have two, the electrons move with different velocities first, but then they go to the same momentum in the end? So that would give some...
I think that's exactly what you say. Normally one would correlate that with two different energies, and that's the ET.
Yeah, you need a
delta E times T is a phase difference, and divided by delta E gives you the time, whatever. Yeah, but here, in addition, you have basically a difference in the action you accumulate or phase due to the different potentials, your PDX. And that, I think, makes it a bit problematic. And this on the Wigner-Smith, that's of course not there because it's not local. I mean, it's quantum mechanics. There is no PDX. This is classical. There is a clear PDX from two different trajectories.
Yeah. But the question that I would have, I mean, that's okay, there, I don't have an answer. That's really also my question, I would say, is, I mean, based on these results, I mean, would it make sense or would it be promising to think about ultrasecond experiments where at the end, the two things where we would hope to measure, that we would hope to measure a time delay between, that we somehow find a way to make them interfere with each other. Which, as far as I can tell, I mean, so far in the experiments that I've seen, well, maybe in the rabbit, this was, you could argue this is already happening.
The most obvious example, in harmonic generations, you have long trajectories and short trajectories.
Yes.
So you have phase difference between the two, but how can this be translated to any time delay? The time delay between what? Normally,
the principle would be the time delay between the ultrasecond pulses associated with those two.
The concept of time delay comes from the dispersion. You have a wave packet which disperses in the medium. So, and this means that the group velocity is not equal to phase velocity. And that's where the concept of time delay comes. So, in your case, your potential is not dispersive, or it is strongly dispersive, or like if it was a wave packet propagating in your media, would it disperse?
I think it would.
Then you probably can introduce some meaningful time delay for the dispersion of this wave packet.
Yeah, so that's my question. This is my last slide. I mean, that's my question to you. I mean, whether it is useful to think about ultrasecond experiments that try to, you know, build interference in order to get. Because there's many ways that you can make things interfere in ultrasecond experiments.
I think it's totally meaningful. Yeah. So I'm coming more and more to the point of view that actually in the frequency domain, it's almost much easier and more stringent. Formulate things and then translate to the time domain. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So this is what you say with interferences. But I think your example, at least really I have to think about it, I think this is quite tricky. And I think the reason is that you go to classical mechanics. So you base this really on trajectories which are local. And then one has to travel, then one has additionally this momentum position information where the trajectories differ. What you just said, right? It's wave packet. This is not local again. It's just a version of the whole thing. And also, because this time delay, this gets rid of this problem that you get additional structure by having two local trajectories eventually. But maybe
is that essential
interpretation even in the end? Who knows? I mean, because in the end, what you measure something, and that was the interpretation of the trajectory.
It's just how we calculate it.
Right? So exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I didn't show that, but I mean, we have TDC wave packet calculations simulating this experiment. That's also a way you can recover all this stuff.
So you did quantum simulation as well?
Yes.
And it sort of...
it matches exactly. I mean, here are the two curves. I mean, one is the measurement and the other one is the quantum simulation. So this basically was the code that Francis Robichaud developed. Okay, thank you.
Will you make your talk available on the web?
Sure.
It's already
recorded. It's been recorded.
Yeah, sure.